Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome, or welcome back. I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 45 is out now over on our Patreon. We're talking about a 16th birthday party invitation that got taken over online, and it turned into a Project X event that tens of thousands of people were invited to. When that event finally did happen, it turned into a riot outside of a 16-year-old's home. What should have been a normal 16th birthday party turned into the destruction of a small town in the Netherlands and cars flipped over and on fire. You can get access to that episode and 44 others and vote on stories you want to hear at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. But today, I'm going to be telling you about a woman who used her charm and quick thinking to not only save the life of her 6-year-old son, but escape a horrific fate herself that so many met at the hands of the Casanova killer, Paul John Knowles. Before we begin, I want to give a content warning for child abuse and neglect and sexual assault and rape. Listener discretion is advised. But with that said, let's get into the case of Barbara Mabee Abel and how she survived one of the most heinous serial killers of all time. Paul John Knowles was born in Orlando, Florida on April 25, 1946, to parents Thomas Jefferson Knowles and Bonnie Strickland, and was one of 7 children. For Paul's entire life, his family struggled, and they lived in a house that was far too small to accommodate the family of 9. They didn't even have a bathroom inside. The whole family shared an outhouse in the backyard. Thomas Knowles was an angry and violent man who would beat his children when they were bad, which was often because they were children. The abuse was constant in their household, and he scared his children into silence about his abuse by telling them if they ever said anything about their treatment at home, they'd be taken away and put into a home, which would be way worse than anything he could ever do to them. Knowles' mother, who was also likely a victim of her husband's violent behavior, didn't stand in the way of Thomas' abuse toward their children. However, despite that, Bonnie is considered Paul John Knowles' first love. He loved his mother very much. At 8 years old, Paul John Knowles was already committing crimes with his brothers, like petty thefts around town. He was terrible in school, he didn't do his work, he terrorized his teachers, and he beat up other kids on the playground. As he grew into his teenage years, his bad behavior only escalated, and he began getting into trouble with police, as did his brothers, which brought a lot of unwanted attention onto the family. Thomas was also definitely doing illegal things, but he was doing them quietly, and his sons were bringing a lot of police attention on his home, which wasn't good for him. After enough time, Thomas had had enough of that, and contacted child services himself, and surrendered all of his children to foster care. He didn't want them, he didn't care about them, or love them. He wanted them gone. And so they were taken away. Paul and his siblings at that point were in foster care, which didn't stop them from their criminal activities. If anything, it made their crimes worse. Around that time, Paul went out to parties. He spent what little money he had at arcades, and instead of going home, he regularly slept in the woods. He was a lot to handle for his foster families, and he bounced around a lot in the system, until finally he was sent to Dozier School for Boys, which was a state-run reform school in Marianna, Florida, notorious for over a century of widespread abuse, forced labor, and very suspicious deaths of the children in its care. Boys who went to that school later came out and told stories about enduring extremely brutal beatings daily, to the point where there were bloodstains on the walls that none of the staff even bothered to clean up. And that's barely scratching the surface. The allegations that came out of that place are crazy. It's a case that's been on my radar for a long time, so I'm sure at some point I will get into the specifics of that story, but point being, it was a horrific place. And it's not actually known how long Knowles was at Dozier, but he was there. Knowles' first known incarceration as an adult was at the age of 19. He was sent to Florida State Prison for kidnapping a police officer at gunpoint. He initially stole a car, but when he was pulled over in the stolen vehicle, Knowles ambushed the police officer, got a hold of his gun, and threatened the officer with his own gun before telling him to get into the back of the car. He pretty clearly didn't have any plans for this because he held the officer hostage for a few hours before he dropped him off on the side of the road, and then was later found and arrested. While serving his sentence, he started corresponding with a woman named Angela Kovic, who was a cocktail waitress in San Francisco, California. He got in contact with her through the magazine American Astrology. Angela's mother actually owned the magazine, and somehow he got Angela's information through the magazine or from an article that had been written about her. And when Angela received her first letter from Paul Knowles, she was instantly taken with him. She thought he was really charming, and she also really liked his handwriting, which was something she found very attractive. So she decided to write back to Paul, and very quickly from there, they started a romantic pen pal relationship. Angela had recently been divorced and was looking for someone new, and this charming stranger came out of nowhere, which she liked. In one of the letters he wrote her, he said, quote, "There's only two things I like to do on a rainy day, sleep and make love. And I very seldom get sleepy," which is quite the line. Things must have been pretty slow in San Francisco because she ate that up. They also bonded over their shared interests in horoscopes and fortune telling. Knowles apparently was super into astrology and checked his horoscope every day, so they bonded over that. And eventually, Angela fell head over heels for him and flew across the country to visit him in prison. During their first visit, he asked her to marry him, and she accepted. Which was a good move for Paul Knowles because Angela had money and connections.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Because of their quickly developing love story, Angela decided she'd pay for Paul's defense and legal fees and hire him criminal defense attorney Sheldon Yavitz, who we will come to find out was not a very good guy. A great guy to have in your corner if you were a criminal, but not a person with very good morals at all. In May of 1974, Yavitz managed to convince the parole board to grant Knowles his freedom, and on that very same day, he got on a plane to San Francisco to see Angela, and basically move in with her. And this was only months after meeting Angela. Angela was older than Knowles, and supposedly wasn't very attractive, but what she did have was lots of money, and Knowles probably saw her as a way out of the bad life that he had been dealt. Even though at this point he was already an adult and had made many poor decisions that have impacted where he has landed. But I can't deny that the beginning of his life was very bleak and no child deserves what he went through. But point being, to him, Angela was probably his ticket out, or at least a very good stepping stone. But soon after he moved in with Angela, they began having problems, which isn't very surprising considering they didn't know each other very well at all. And Paul Knowles is one of the most brutal serial killers ever, so I can't imagine he'd be the most easy person to coexist with. But what's kind of funny is the reason they broke up. Their whirlwind romance would be cut short when Angela went to go see a fortune teller, which was an interest that she and Knowles both ironically shared. The fortune teller told her that a dark presence had entered her life, and a bad man had arrived and would cause her nothing but misery. And yeah, she hit the nail on the head with that one. This is a bad man for sure. So because of that, and with the issues they were already having, Angela went home and promptly called off their engagement and told Knowles he needed to get out. And I'm proud of Angela for that one. Sure, she got swept up in the whirlwind romance of it all and found him very charming and accepted his proposal the moment she met him in prison. But the second the psychic was like, a bad man has come into your life, she was able to say, I think I know who this bad man might be. Maybe it's the man who I just got out of prison who I'm engaged to, who was in prison for kidnapping a police officer. Maybe it's him. And then she promptly kicked him out and he left and she's fine. So that's great. Kind of funny how she got there, but I'll take it. It's believed something in Paul John Knowles broke when Angela called off their engagement. I think he was just a ticking time bomb and this break was inevitable, but this is when his killing spree began. The night that Angela called off their engagement, Knowles later claimed to have murdered 3 people on the streets of San Francisco. That was never verified, but is believed to be true, because what followed was a 4-month killing spree across the country. After that night, Knowles got on a plane back to Florida where he was picked up by his brother and was soon arrested after stabbing a bartender during a fight. But he picked a lock in his holding cell and escaped on July 26, 1974. From there, his killing spree really began, and he wouldn't stop until November when he was caught. Barbara Mabee Abel was born a twin in Detroit, Michigan. Her twin sister Beverly, who she called Bevy, was born with cerebral palsy. They were fraternal, but they always knew each other's thoughts and feelings. They definitely had that twin connection and were always extremely close. Barbara said Beverly was smart, funny, and very fun, and Barbara was the more serious one. They lived with their mom, dad, and older sister Jackie and brother Gary. But all of a sudden, when Barbara was 6 years old, her father passed away. After that, their mother decided she needed a new beginning and moved the family to West Palm Beach, Florida. She got a job as a saleswoman and bought a house for the 5 of them to live in, which is actually the house that Barbara still lives in today. And Barbara's mother was so proud to buy that house in the 50s and make it her own. It was a great house for the family, and it was safe. Barbara loved her new life in Florida. She loved the neighborhood and she made friends easily, including Eleanor Pettis, who was Barbara's best friend since the 7th grade. They became like sisters, and she said Barbara was very outgoing and they got along very well and could talk to each other about anything. Eleanor was by Barbara's side through everything, and the two stayed close even after they both got married and Barbara moved to Georgia with her husband. Barbara's only son, Dale, was born in April of 1968, when Barbara was in her early 20s. Dale was the light of Barbara's life from the moment she brought him home from the hospital. He had red hair and blue eyes, and she couldn't get over how cute he was. However, Barbara's marriage was short-lived, and she and Dale moved back in with Barbara's mother and twin sister, Beverly, in West Palm Beach. And that was good for Barbara, because now she had extra help with Dale. And because of that, she decided to get a job, that way she could save some money. Which was when she felt like she found her calling. Someone suggested Barbara get a job at WIRK, the radio station in West Palm Beach. She worked at the station as a receptionist at first, but after some time, she worked her way up and wound up learning how to record commercials. And she loved her work. She was instantly hooked. And from there, she wanted to become a copywriter and started writing commercials as well as recording them. Barbara had always dreamed of being a writer, so this was a perfect job for her. Things felt like they had really fallen into place for Barbara. She had her dream job, she was living with her mother in Beverly, Dale was the most adorable thing ever. Things were great. But a few years later, in May of 1974, Barbara's mother sadly passed away. Both Barbara and Beverly were devastated at the loss of their mother, but as time went on, they made things work with just the two of them and Dale. And by November, things were beginning to look up for them once again. However, their lives would change forever on November 14th, 1974. That Thursday morning started out like any other day. Barbara had gotten up and got ready for work. 6-year-old Dale got ready for school, and Beverly got situated with her breakfast. Barbara dropped off Dale at school, and she went to work where she started writing commercials. Around noon, Barbara tried calling Beverly at home, but she didn't pick up, which Barbara thought was strange because her sister always answered the phone. Barbara didn't immediately freak out, but she knew it was odd that Beverly hadn't answered the phone. That was a very regular thing for them to do. After work, she picked up Dale and drove home from the nursery school before walking up to the door with him. After unlocking the door, the two of them shouted into the house for Beverly, as they normally would do, but this time they got no answer. She told Dale, "Go look for Bevy. I'm gonna go get some water, honey." So he ran further into the house as Barbara walked into the kitchen. When she got to the sink and began filling a glass, she suddenly had a horrible feeling wash over her body as chills ran up and down her arms. She didn't know what had come over her, whether it was instinct or fear, but she turned around and saw standing in front of her was a man with a sawed-off shotgun pointed at her. So she put her hands up. In that same moment, Dale ran toward the kitchen, saying, "Bevy's in the bedroom and she's bleeding." So Barbara, who was in frozen eye contact with this man, with her hands up, told him, "I want to see my sister. I want to see Beverly." Knowles took Barbara into the bedroom with Dale, which is when she immediately went over to her sister, who was on the bed. Beverly was under the covers, but she was crying as Barbara rested her hands on her to comfort her. When she pulled back the covers a bit, she could see that Beverly had been bound and gagged and had blood dripping from her mouth. She put her hands on Beverly's shoulder. She bent down and kissed her and told her how much she loved her and told her they were going to be okay because God was going to get them out of this. She pulled back the bedspread some more and saw that Beverly had been completely undressed, which was when Barbara lost it because she knew what had just happened. She turned to Knowles, who was still holding the shotgun, and asked, "Did you rape her? Because if you raped her, I'm going to kill you." He started laughing and said he tried. Barbara felt terror and asked him, "Why are you doing this?" He told her, "My name is John, and I don't want to go back to jail. I just need money and your car." She told him she had money. She would get it for him. It was her mortgage money, but that didn't mean anything to her at this point. She just wanted this monster out of their home. Knowles then said, "And I'm going to take your son." Barbara froze for a moment. No way was she going to let him take her son. She immediately stepped in front of Dale and said, "Take me instead." She knew that this man could very easily kill her, but her top priority was to get out of the house with this man and make sure that Beverly and Dale would be safe. Once she did that, she could hope and pray that this man didn't kill her. Knowles then tied Dale up, and as he did that, Barbara told Dale to please act like a big boy. And she told him, "We're going to be okay." He got Barbara's keys. He already had the money. And then they went out the front door to the car. And as Barbara said, they drove off into the sunset. He asked Barbara where the interstate was, so she got him northbound on A1A. He turned up the radio as he drove, and as he listened, Barbara could tell he was getting angry. He told her to switch the stations to listen to the news. Barbara didn't know what he wanted to hear so badly. But that was when he told her he had killed people, and he wanted to hear what they were saying about him. Barbara was terrified. It was then she decided she was going to do whatever she needed to survive. She wanted to save her life and get back to Dale and Beverly, so she decided she'd try being really nice to him, and almost flirt with him, and see where that got her. So she started talking about movies and beautiful songs of the 70s. She wanted to make him fall in love with her. She said, "Honey, do you want a cigarette?" And he asked her, "Why are you calling me honey?" She told him, "Why not? You're not a bad guy. You remind me of Robert Redford, the movie star." He said, "I do?" She said, "Well, you kinda do. You're not bad looking." She couldn't lay it on too thick, but she was definitely complimenting him. And he was liking what she was saying, because after that he became very responsive in the way that she was treating him. He was actually happy to be talking to her, and he told her that. Because he said he had silence all day being in her home with Beverly. What a horrifying thing to hear and then have to just not react. But but she's already had to not react to so much in order to survive. And she's already kind of got him, because at that point, he started opening up a little bit about his family. He told Barbara that he had had a rough childhood with his father. He told her he was raised in Jacksonville in a Christian family, and he had brothers and sisters. He then asked her about her work and said, "I heard from your sister that you wrote something." She told him, "I work at the radio station. I'm a copywriter." Which was when he asked her if she knew how to write books. To which Barbara asked him, why did he want to write a book? And he told her that he wanted to be famous. Barbara asked him what he wanted to be famous for, which he didn't answer. And she didn't continue the conversation after that, which was probably wise. As Barbara and Paul John Knowles continued north, a vehicle had been recovered by police in West Palm Beach. The car had been stolen from a man named William Bates back in September, and his strangled body wouldn't be discovered until months later in Ohio. Inside that vehicle, police found insurance cards and credit cards belonging to a man named Carswell Carr, who had also been murdered in a double homicide in November of 1974, along with his 15-year-old daughter, Amanda Carr, in Georgia, only days before Barbara was abducted. Carswell and Amanda Carr had been found in their ransacked home. Police didn't know this at the time, but it's believed Knowles and 45-year-old Carswell allegedly had a brief romantic encounter, or as many articles called it, a quote-unquote friendship. But Knowles was invited back to Carswell's home, and it seemed as if he and Carr had been potentially having a romantic evening together before Knowles stabbed Carr more than 27 times with a pair of scissors. He then suffocated Carr's 15-year-old daughter, who was in the home at the time. It was the most brutal crime scene most of the officers had ever seen. Based on the severity of the attack, investigators figured a quote-unquote lunatic must have committed the crime. They had no idea who they were looking for when they were called to that scene because Paul John Knowles wasn't connected to these people at all. But inside the stolen vehicle, they discovered Carr's insurance cards and ID, and the will of a man named Paul John Knowles. They think he was attempting to steal Carr's identity. At the time, they had no idea that Paul John Knowles was a serial killer traveling across the country on a 4-month rampage, but they were piecing together that he must have been the person responsible for at least 3 murders at this point. Little did they know, there were a lot more than 3 bodies. Starting in the summer of 1974, Paul John Knowles went on a rampage across the country, killing pretty much anyone in his path. Age did not matter to him. Whenever he had the urge to kill, whoever was there would become his next victim. On August 1st, Knowles killed a 13-year-old girl hitchhiking near Macon, Georgia, who was later identified as Imogene Sanders. He raped, strangled, and left her in the woods between some trees. His youngest victims, according to Knowles, were 11-year-old Lillian Annette Anderson and 7-year-old Millette Josephine Anderson. He claimed to have kidnapped and murdered them just outside of Jacksonville, Florida, on August 1st as well. However, the girl's disappearance was never solved. And investigators said they believed this was a false confession, and I definitely hope it was a false confession. Because 7 years old, and 11, and 13, I mean, my God. 35-year-old Karen Wine and her daughter, 15-year-old Dawn, were also found dead on October 6th. That day, Knowles broke into their home and made them eat dinner with him before he tied them up, strangled, and sexually assaulted them. Doris Hosey was a 53-year-old woman found shot dead in her home, and Knowles shot her with her husband's gun. He also reportedly picked up hitchhikers along the way, 23-year-old Edward Hilliard and 20-year-old Debbie Griffin, whose remains were found near Macon, Georgia. And those are only a few of Paul John Knowles' horrifying murders and crimes, but there were many more. The will that was found in William Bates' abandoned car identified the names of Knowles' attorney, Sheldon Yavitz. So authorities called him, hoping he could help them find him. When West Palm Beach police contacted him, he told them to look up Knowles' criminal record and they would learn all they needed to know. So within 3 hours, they had Knowles' fingerprints and picture, which was helpful, because now they had his name and they knew who they were looking for, but that didn't solve the issue of locating him. So police began their search in the West Palm Beach area, but they had no idea that Barbara was trapped beside him, headed north in her Volkswagen, while Beverly and Dale were still tied up in their family home. Barbara knew that her captor had killed multiple people because he told her, but she didn't know the extent. Even still, she knew how evil this man was and thought about attempting to push him out the door, but she was too tired and scared to actually try it. After a while of driving, Knowles also got tired and decided they were going to stop for the night at a motel off the side of the highway in Fort Pierce. He parked the car in front at the office, and when he stopped, Barbara told him, "You can drop me off and leave with the car." But he told her, no, she would be coming with him. He grabbed the sawed-off shotgun, put it under his coat, and then they went to the front office to check in. As Barbara got out of the car, she had to take a deep breath because she was almost shaking. On their way in, he turned to Barbara and told her, "We're married. I'll think of a name when we get to the front desk, but we're married." She knew she had to do a good job and come off as being calm, even though inside her guts were churning. At the front desk, he put his arm around her waist, pretending like they were a couple, and told the person checking them in they were Mr. and Mrs. Joe Smith. Barbara thought to herself she should put her arm around him too, because she wanted this woman to believe they were actually married. She figured if she said anything to this woman, Knowles would kill this woman and her too, which she obviously did not want. So she put her arm around Knowles as well, and this act worked. The woman gave him the key to room 10. Once in the room, Knowles told Barbara to get undressed. She told him she didn't want to do anything, but he didn't care, and once again told her to get undressed. That night, Barbara was raped, or he attempted to. Barbara said throughout her time with him, he would attempt to rape her, but he wouldn't be able to because he was impotent. When Knowles couldn't finish, he became furious, which was when he grabbed Barbara's thumb and tried to break her finger. He then grabbed her hair, and she thought he was going to beat her to death, so she frantically asked him what he was doing, which was when he completely switched up and started profusely apologizing to her. He was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. She didn't know from one moment to the next if she was going to be killed. But the act she had been playing with him, that she actually loved him, was working, because although he was still being violent and brutal toward her, he had stopped, which it seems like was something he had not really done up until this point, considering he's left a trail of bodies behind him. He then took the sheet and ripped it apart and used the torn pieces to tie her wrists and ankles to the bed and tied a piece around her head to gag her. The whole time, Barbara was praying that she would get out of this and go home to Beverly and Dale. That night, as Barbara was finally dozing off, she said she saw her mother, who came to her in a dream. She said her mother was like an angel and told Barbara that she was going to be okay and God was with her. When Barbara woke up, Knowles untied her and turned on the TV. As they watched the news, they saw their pictures flash across the screen. Barbara knew that Paul John Knowles had killed people, but now she was learning a bit more about his crimes. She didn't dare say anything, because he was watching so intensely, she felt like if she interrupted, he would slap her or do something even more violent, so she just sat there and let him listen to the news. Barbara was just watching him watch the screen so intently, and she thought to herself, this was why he wanted her to write him his book. So she thought to herself, if he brought it up again, she would tell him that she knew how to write his book, as another way to gain his favor. Watching the broadcast, she also learned that her son and sister were safe, and she felt a flood of relief wash over her. She still had to hold it together and did not want him to know that this had affected her in the way that it had, but inside, she was sobbing. Apparently, 6-year-old Dale had been able to free himself and his aunt before getting help from the neighbor who called the police for them. Police knew that Paul Knowles was hard to track down at this point, and it appeared that he was an interstate traveler. He would use cars and license plates from his crimes along the way, as well as credit cards and people's names. They had also learned enough about him to know that there wasn't a lot of hope of finding Barbara alive. And if they had any hope of finding her alive, they would have to work very fast. So they had officers out looking for her car, trying to track them down, because now they knew that Barbara and Paul John Knowles had left in Barbara's car. They put out numerous BOLOs, or be on the lookouts, for Knowles, because they had the description of Barbara's car, which was a gold-colored Volkswagen, which was not a very common car at the time. They had established a search perimeter around the entire West Palm Beach area, and everyone was on the lookout for Barbara's stolen car. The issue was, Barbara was trapped in a motel room nearly 70 miles north of West Palm Beach. They were already outside of the perimeter. When they went to bed that first night on Thursday, he took her ankle and tied it to his, which made it absolutely impossible for her to sleep. It would have been hard for her to sleep regardless because she was tied up in the dark next to a serial killer, but now she was tied to him. It was around that time the FBI paid another visit to Sheldon Yavitz, Knowles' attorney. They wanted to know more about the will found in the stolen vehicle and to see if he knew where his client was, even though they had done that before and he didn't tell them anything. At the time, authorities only suspected Knowles for 3 murders and Barbara's kidnapping. They had no idea of the scale of his murder spree. But then they read in Knowles' will that he was going to record a confession tape of all of his crimes that he was committing, and then he would give it to Yavitz, who would put the tape in a safe deposit box to keep safe until one of 2 things happened. 1, that he was killed committing his crimes, or 2, that he gave a written release for Yavitz to release the tape. So when the police learn that there is a tape of Paul John Knowles admitting to all of his crimes, recorded, and Yavitz has it in his possession, they of course wanted that tape. They considered that to be a goldmine of evidence on what Knowles had done. It was the kind of piece of evidence that almost never falls into the laps of investigators, and here it was. It was a recorded confession of his crimes. As it turned out, 3 weeks before Barbara's kidnapping in October of 1974, Yavitz met Knowles in a bar in Miami, and Knowles told him, according to him, he said, quote, "I want you to know I'm a mass murderer." Yavitz told him, "I really don't want to know that." But Knowles told him, "But I want to tell you what I've done. I've got to tell somebody. They've got to know what I've done for the future." Yavitz then asked him if he wanted to give himself up, and Knowles told him no, but someday he wanted people to know that he's killed all these people, basically meaning he wanted to be famous. He wanted to record a confession of all of his crimes and give it to his lawyer for his lawyer to hold for the future. That way he could be famous in the future. And so he told Yavitz that was his plan. He would put his confession on a tape and then he would give it to him. The next day, he presented Yavitz with this tape. And according to Yavitz, he never listened to the tape. He just put it in an envelope and locked it in a safe in his home. And then he didn't see Paul John Knowles after that. So he didn't know where he was. And it was at this point in my research that I had to stand up from my laptop and take a lap, because I could not believe that someone would gain access to a recorded confession of a serial killer's crimes and not immediately turn it over to the police. That is wild to me. He told him flat out, "I am a mass murderer, and I'm going to give you a recorded confession of everything that I've done for the purposes of me becoming famous in the future." And Yavitz just said, "Sure, sounds good." He didn't do anything with that tape. And as if that wasn't bad enough, when investigators approached him about the tape and asked him for it, he refused to give it to them, saying it was within lawyer-client privilege, so he was not going to help them. The investigator told him, "You are the worst person we've ever seen. You're horrible." And when recalling that, Yavitz laughed and said, "Okay." Actually, when recalling this entire interaction, he laughed the entire time when he recalled meeting up with Paul John Knowles in the bar, who told him he was a mass murderer. He was laughing about that too. Obviously, Paul John Knowles is the absolute worst person in this case, but to me, Sheldon Yavitz is honestly just a couple notches below him. I cannot believe that. The amount of lives he could have saved is unbelievable to me, and it seems like he doesn't lose any sleep over it. In fact, it's funny to him. So when the investigator told him, "You are the worst person we've ever seen, you're horrible," I wholeheartedly agree. You are horrible. And I hope you have the life you deserve. As for Barbara, she made it through the night with very little, if no sleep at all. By the time the sun came up on November 15th, she had been captive for 18 hours. That morning, Knowles told Barbara he was hungry and wanted to take her out to eat. So he took her down the road to a small diner. When they walked in the door, she smelled freshly baked bread and saw a bunch of normal people eating and having a normal morning. As they were seated, she thought maybe she could get away. But Knowles had the shotgun with him under his coat. He took off his coat and put the gun on the seat and covered it, still pointed at her. As the elderly waitress came over and began taking their order, Barbara remained calm. He ordered orange juice, bacon, eggs, and hash browns. The entire time, Barbara wondered why nobody had noticed them when their pictures had been all over the news last night. She realized nobody was going to help her, which was when she turned back on the acting. She had to keep up the act that she enjoyed being with him, because it had worked once before, so hopefully it would continue to work. He had a shotgun, and she didn't want to put anyone else in danger. She thought to herself, if he was going to kill her, he was going to kill her. But she didn't want to put anyone else in harm's way. And if she made a scene in this diner, he most likely would kill a lot more people than just her. Barbara continues to prove how selfless of a person she actually is, and how strong and brave she is, which is in stark contrast to Sheldon Yavitz. You got the best of them and the worst of them. After they finished breakfast, Knowles brought her back to the motel and attempted to rape her again, but once again couldn't perform and got mad. So Barbara had to do reverse psychology and make him think that he was really great so he would calm down and not kill her. She was so convincing that Knowles said, "I wish I would have met you before all of this happened." And when the news came on again later, he became unhappy once again. And this time he took it out on Barbara. He pulled out the gun, held it up toward her head, and said, "Bang, bang," before he started laughing hysterically. Knowles then tied Barbara up in the same way he had done the day prior, before stepping outside to make a phone call. As Barbara lay in the room alone, she spent every second thinking about getting out of there and going home to be with her sister and her son. All of a sudden, she looked over at the nightstand and realized that the motel room key was there. Knowles had accidentally locked himself out of the room. When he came back to the room, he tried opening the door, but it was locked, and he didn't have another key. Barbara felt like this was a miracle, and she held her breath, not knowing what was going to happen. He tried for a few minutes and banged on the door, but after realizing he wasn't going to be able to get back in, Knowles said through the door, "When they pick you up, don't tell them that I hurt you, and I love you." And then there was silence. Barbara didn't want to scream for help because she was worried that he was outside, and he would kill anyone out there, and her too, so she did what she could to free herself. She wiggled herself free from the bedpost, and then from the sheets binding her hands and feet. By 7 a.m., 2 days after her kidnapping, Barbara was finally free. She called the front desk and told the woman who answered the phone her name and that she had been kidnapped by a serial killer. When law enforcement arrived, they came with the FBI and a whole team of crime lab people to collect as much evidence as possible. Barbara went to the motel front office, where she had a phone call waiting for her, from Beverly. They spoke for the first time in 2 days, and Barbara was able to tell her sister she was okay, and then was able to talk to Dale and tell him that she was coming home soon, which was a very emotional moment for Barbara. But she was rescued. Paul John Knowles, however, had escaped, so police put out another bolo for Barbara's car. A Florida state trooper was patrolling out of Perry, not far from the Georgia line, and he saw the stolen car and stopped Knowles. Knowles still had a double-barrel sawed-off shotgun, so when he was pulled over, he pulled that on the trooper as he walked up to the window and was able to take him hostage next. Knowles then put the trooper in the back seat of the patrol car and drove off in that. He knew he couldn't keep driving a patrol car, so he ended up pulling over a businessman, James Meyer, who was only supposed to be in town for a few days. Talk about wrong place, wrong time. And he ended up taking both the trooper and James Meyer hostage as they left in Meyer's car. He then drove them to a gas station in Lakeland, Georgia, and the attendant at the gas station observed a state trooper and another man in the back seat of a car as another man pumped the gas, which seemed kind of weird. And so because something seemed off about this random group, he decided to report it to authorities. The kidnapping of a police officer was basically unheard of, so it became national news, and there was a real urgency to track him down and get them before he killed his hostages. The next day, Knowles was spotted in Henry County. A deputy sheriff saw the car and recognized it was the wanted car, so the deputy radioed ahead and had a roadblock set up. And everyone from the Metro Atlanta area who had a badge and a gun was there. Pretty much every cop in the state of Georgia was there. So Knowles crashed into the roadblock, and at that point, he abandoned the car and fled on foot into the woods. He began running and still had his shotgun, so began exchanging gunfire with authorities who were pursuing him, and they shot Knowles in the leg as he took off. It turned out it wasn't the entire police force in the state of Georgia who got Knowles in the woods, but a random young man who was out rabbit hunting, who saw him in the woods, I think up against a tree, but Knowles was exhausted from running and losing blood, so he just gave up. So this random rabbit hunter apprehended Knowles. And a reporter who interviewed this random guy said, "You met him with the shotgun? He had a shotgun, so he could have killed you right then? Were you scared?" And the guy said, "No, not really." What the hell? Very random, but they got him. So authorities came and took Knowles into custody. And Barbara and Beverly were both very relieved to see on TV that Knowles had been found and arrested. When authorities realized Knowles didn't have the trooper or Myers in the car, they assumed the worst. And when he was arrested, he refused to say where the men were. Several days later, a deer hunter discovered the bodies of Trooper Charles Campbell and businessman James Meyer in the woods in Georgia. Knowles had handcuffed both men to a tree and shot them in the back of the head, execution style. Based on the caliber of the bullet, authorities believed Knowles used Campbell's own gun to kill them both. Knowles was already never getting away with his crimes, but once the men were discovered, it was really over for him. So he agreed to take authorities to Henry County and show them where he ditched the trooper's pistol. But as they were driving down the I-20 into Atlanta, Knowles somehow smuggled a paperclip into the car and used it to pick the handcuffs on his belly chain. He then lunged at the officers and got his hands on one of their guns, and so they began firing at him and continued firing. And then it was over. Paul John Knowles was dead. Part of me wonders if that was his plan all along, just to be killed out there and have that be his grand ending so he could be the famous Paul John Knowles. I don't know. But when Barbara got the news, she said it was one of the best days of her life. Before Knowles was killed, his lawyer was thrown in jail for contempt because he wouldn't tell them where the tape was. But eventually he agreed to give them the tape if it was sealed by the judge until the court appeals determined whether lawyer-client privilege existed. Knowles was killed in December, so in January a judge ruled that the lawyer-client privilege died with him, which was when the judge listened to the tape and to all the confessions that he made. Although Knowles was killed before he could be prosecuted for his crimes, the tape solved 20 of their homicides, but he claimed he killed a lot more. In one of his interviews, he bragged that he killed at least 35 people, which honestly doesn't seem far-fetched to me because he gave that recorded tape to Yavitz weeks before he even kidnapped Barbara. So the number is definitely higher than 20. It's possible he's embellishing because he wants that fame. He wants to be the most horrendous, awful serial killer, obviously. So I'm hoping that he's embellishing. But also it seems that the number is definitely higher than 20 because the tape alone confirmed 20 of their homicides. Knowles said that he felt that of everything he did in his life, the only thing that he had been successful at was killing people. Ew. His lawyer said he intended to become famous and then make a lot of money, which he could then give to his mother, so him being a serial killer was actually a good deed for his mother. Do you want a gold star? The Good Son Award goes to... Like, I'm sorry, you murdered 22 people, minimum, but probably a lot more than that. And you're like, no, it was for my mommy. Gross! Gross! He wanted a book and a movie made, and the media was all over it, calling him the Casanova Killer, which honestly, I do despise. I do hate that that is the name that they chose to give him. And when Barbara saw a magazine with Paul John Knowles' picture and an article calling him the Casanova killer, she couldn't believe it. She was also disgusted. Because why are we romanticizing a monster? But people were saying, oh, he's so good looking, he's so charming, and blah, blah, blah. He used his charm to lure people in. I actually don't know about that. He isn't a bad looking person, but like, I'm also very anti-romanticizing serial killers. So pick a new name. He's also been called the most heinous mass murderer in American history and has been compared to Ted Bundy. And some people have even said he's worse than Ted Bundy. So yeah, it's just his crimes are really bad. But something I am actually glad about is that I did not even know about the Casanova killer until pretty recently. That is not the name of a serial killer that you hear, I feel like, in mainstream conversation about serial killers. Like, sure, you hear about Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy or Jeffrey Dahmer, but he's not as famous as he wanted to be, which makes me happy because that is what he wanted. He wanted to be remembered. He wanted notoriety. And did he get some of that? Sure. But also, you're not as cool as you think you are. You're actually not cool at all. You're pathetic. Authorities were hoping that the tape would give them more answers, but unfortunately it wouldn't. And actually the tape was destroyed in a flood at the federal courthouse in Macon, Georgia, and no longer exists. Because the tape was destroyed, no one really knows how many people Knowles actually killed. For Barbara, his death was an incredible sigh of relief for her and her family, but it didn't erase the trauma that she, Beverly, and Dale endured. Dale was only 6 years old and needed help dealing with it. He became very protective of his mother and was afraid of leaving her when she would drop him off at school. They had the pastors at his church school talk to all three of them and pray over them, hoping that would help. And since then, he's done very well, and he actually has his own business now. Barbara also, of course, struggled as well and decided to go to West Palm Beach Mental Health Center for a while. She said that was great for her. And Beverly couldn't talk about the kidnappings for several years. There were many times when Barbara wanted to move out of the house where she was kidnapped from, but it dawned on her that they were living in their mother's house, and there was so much love there and so many good memories there. There were way more good memories than there were bad, and she had built a beautiful life there with Beverly and Dale, so she decided to stay. And then she fell in love with Jim, the love of her life. Jim Abel and Barbara have been married for 44 years, I believe. She met Jim in 1973. He was going overseas, and they decided to keep in touch, so he became her friend and was writing her all that time. She had feelings for him early on, but after everything happened, he was a big support for her. He was still away, but one day she wrote him a letter telling him about her kidnapping and what happened to her. And that letter hit Jim really hard, and he knew she needed someone. And he had strong feelings for her at that time, so he was hoping that he could be that support person that helped her through it. And he was. And now they've been happily married for over 40 years. Barbara said she doesn't think about Paul John Knowles at all anymore. She doesn't need to. She wrote a book called One Survivor, and she's gotten everything off of her chest. So with that, she was able to just let it go, which I think is awesome. She also said, quote, "You can choose to be a victim or you can choose to be a survivor. I chose to be a survivor. I am worth being who I am today. I am somebody. I am a survivor." And I think she is amazing. What a strong, selfless, brave woman to risk her life to save her sister and her son. She sacrificed herself and then continued to sacrifice herself for the people around her. She didn't risk the life of the woman behind the desk at the motel. She didn't risk the lives of the people in the diner because she thought, he's just going to kill more people and then me. So if he's going to kill me anyway, it might as well be only me. I think if anyone deserves to be remembered from this story, it's Barbara Maybe Abel. I don't want to waste my brain space on people who don't deserve it. People who hurt other people or are actively complicit in it, which is almost as bad. I'm so happy for Barbara and her family. And Jim seems so sweet as well. Seeing them together was so nice, and he just seems like such a pure soul. When he talked about hearing about what she had gone through and saying that he wanted to be that support person for her, the way he talked about it was like, I want to be that support person for her if she'll allow me to. I want to be in her life if she's ready to have someone in her life. Like, it was very much, if you want me, I'm here for you. If you're ready for me, I want you. I love you. And I just thought that was so beautiful because it wasn't like, I'm here to save the day. I'm going to take care of you. It was like, I would love to be in your life and support you, but only if you want me to be here and if you want that. Like, I thought that was amazing too. So yeah, I am so happy for Barbara. I'm so happy that she stayed in her family home and that she has that perspective of there's so many more beautiful memories in this home than there are bad ones. Because that is the home that she mostly grew up in with her mother and her siblings, and she's lived there with Beverly and her son, and it's so amazing. And again, I mean, she's such a strong woman to go through all of that and then to come out on the other side and continue to live in that place and focus on the positives and to not only get herself through it, but her son and her sister, and, you know, continue to live her life in the way that she has. I just think she's amazing. So yeah, I think if anyone in this story, if you're going to choose anyone to remember, I think Barbara Maybe Abel is the one we should focus on. And I think that's all I have to say about that. Why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser, and I'll tell you something good in my life that's completely unrelated so that we can go back to our days as normal. My good thing is that Alex made these almond croissants, which sounds so fancy and felt so fancy, but was actually very simple because we just bought a container of pre-made croissants, which are already amazing, and then cut them open and filled them with like an almond paste filling that he made, which he says is very easy. I was not in the kitchen for the making of the almond paste, but apparently is very easy. And then he just threw it in the oven, heated it up, and bada bing, bada boom, we got an almond croissant. I'm honestly glad that I didn't know that it was this easy to have basically a bakery level almond croissant in my kitchen at any given moment, because that could easily become a problem for me. But I had one at lunch today and it did pick up my afternoon quite a bit. So it's definitely the highlight of my day. We also gave a few to our friends who live nearby, and it's lovely to spread the joy of an almond croissant, a warm one. We put some powdered sugar on those bad boys. It was crazy. So that was my good thing. I hope that you are having a good day, and I hope that you also get a croissant filled with something, whether it be chocolate or almond, or maybe you're a savory person. Dealer's choice. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast to check out all of our bonus episodes. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. I have to catch up and I will do that. I apologize. I am in the middle of wedding planning and I'm doing my best. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast with a T, and then a podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.